Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Jenny Holm, writer, Newbery Honor recipient, Baby Mouse co-creator, who may or may not have witnessed her child do a book report on one of her own books. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 284 of the podcast with Jenny Holm. There isn't a day that goes by in our school library that a Baby Mouse book isn't checked out. Baby Mouse is a staple of our library and a first friend to many emerging readers, but those readers who find their way into Jenny's novels find a home for life, and many even end up, in part, finding a bit of themselves within the stories. Jenny joined me to share Full of Beans, her prequel to Turtle in Paradise, which was awarded the highly distinguished Newbery Honor. But why sit here and discuss all the details when the conversation does such a better job? Here is episode number 284 of the podcast with Jenny Holm. Welcome to the podcast, Jenny Holm. I am super excited to talk to you.
Oh, I am super excited to talk to you.
Dude, you are, you and your brother, but you are pervasive in our library. I think that here, can I just share with you, I guess on record now, my favorite thing about Baby Mouse in our library is that it appears like we have a lot of them until the very end of the school year when we collect all the books back. And we're like, oh my word, there's no room for all of the other ones that were checked out. So I know that that is not a unique story to me. I know that that happens in libraries all across the country. I know that people that share in raising children and raising readers also then have that great experience like I have of getting to say, yeah, well, she writes these graphic novels over here with her brother, but she also writes these amazing historical fiction stories that keep getting awards tagged on them. You should come read them. So
it's so funny because the historical fiction, you know, came before Baby Mouse. Yeah. So I had been writing for many years by the time we started working on Baby Mouse together.
Well, I'm glad that we've got so much different from you. In fact, I say that because I think the thing that happens to come to my mind is that one of my favorite things you did is title, Middle School is Worse Than Meatloaf. Is that
yeah.
right? The like yeah. photo book almost. The way that the stories were arranged in that way is something that I haven't ever really gotten out of my head.
Well, what's funny, the funny story about that book, that's actually the first book that my brother Matt and I collaborated on, but it came out years after Baby Mouse did. He actually did the comics in that.
Oh, well, there yeah. you go. But it still, it wasn't time for it to come out. Baby Mouse had to make her appearance first.
Exactly.
She had something to say. Well, I'm glad that you and Matt and so many others have done such a beautiful job in the role of raising our readers in putting great books into their hands, especially in terms of graphic novels, because I've been an advocate of graphic novels for a long time, but to see parents become advocates of graphic novels because of reading things like Baby Mouse, because of seeing their young readers become fluent readers and become avid readers, it's something that I know you've put a ton of time into all, 9,000 volumes of Baby Mouse,
yeah.
But you've got legions of readers because of it. So, thank you. I'm back at school, Jenny. I'm like already thinking of my readers. I see them next week and I'm just like, it just is such a blessing to know that so many of us, they'll never know how many of us are working for them. Are working exactly. To help them read. It's
And it's great. We do, Matt and I do hear a lot from parents all across the spectrum of how Baby Mouse helped their child to become enthusiastic about reading, or might have helped them overcome some kind of a learning disability with reading because of the nice big visual literacy of it. So we just love getting those emails.
Wow, it's a lovely thing. But let's turn, as I'm so excited to talk about your new middle grade coming out, Full of Beans.
Oh,
it's so good. I was seeing teachers today, and I was like, a couple of my friends, including Miss Haas, my fourth grade teacher. Uh-huh. I read the greatest book over the summer. I need you to read it to your class this year, and she knows you. She knows your work. I should say it that way. It's exciting to have teachers that are excited about reading too, to have that culture in a school. But to know that we've got more adventures in this world, that Full of Beans here has, I need to stop myself and let you share perhaps a book talk. How are you pitching this book to your readers, to teachers and librarians, to everyone? What's your pitch for it?
Well, it's kind of a funny pitch, I guess. It's like a personal pitch. So my son... I have two kids, and my son, Will, he just turned 13 today, actually.
Happy birthday.
I know, I've got puberty in the house now. I have a teen in the house, which is shocking to me. But when my book, Turtle in Paradise, came out, he was still young, and he wasn't able to read it. So he read Turtle in Paradise, which actually takes place in Key West, Florida, during the Great Depression. And he read it many years later, ironically, for a book report that he had to do. I know, it's awful.
Did he choose it? Like, he knew your name was on the cover, right?
I actually think he was kind of slacking out a little bit and wasn't planning ahead, and he had this book in the house. So, yeah, so he did a book report on it. And then after the fact, I said, oh, so did you like it? And he said, oh, you know, it's okay, but... I really want to know about beans. And he wanted to know all about Turtle's cousin who lives in Key West, who's kind of this smart-alecky boy named Beans. And he wanted to know how did the diaper gang get started. And the diaper gang is a group of boys who run a little babysitting operation in Key West. They take care of colicky babies. And, of course, the great irony of him asking me to write this book was he was sort of – part of the origin story originally for Turtle in Paradise. I had there's a whole thread in Turtle in Paradise about these boys who formed the diaper gang to take care of babies who cry a lot. And Will was the baby who was the colicky baby who cried a lot.
He was the one, yeah.
He was. So very funny all these years later to have him ask for this book. And he actually came up with the title. And I thought it was great. So
it's got a lot of spunk. I like it.
Yeah. So,
well, good. Well, in this prequel to Turtle in Paradise, I'm in Maryland, and Turtle in Paradise, I think, was on a lot of state book award lists. It was on our state book award list a couple years ago. So to have something like that, to have a lot of readers have eyes on it, makes it all the more exciting to be able to tell them that, much like what your son went through, that remember that character that you loved. Well, how about How about a different story? And more importantly, one involving crime.
Everybody needs a little crime in their life.
I mean, come on. That sort of subversion in children's books is sort of what... All I need to do is hold up this book and be like, setting fire alarms off falsely. Come on.
I know.
It's good. So, full of beans, then we go back in time a little bit, but we see, which is a couple years, but to see in this story the way that Key West came together, the way that the New Dealers came in and changed things, and to have it be experienced through a child's perspective was something that I really enjoyed a lot in this story.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible story, and it's, this is sort of these fun things that happen when you are doing research, especially historical fiction. You kind of learn about these things slowly. So usually the way I research my books is I do just some broad research on the internet, but I inevitably go and just start hanging out at an archive, like whatever the local archive is. And sort of the longer you hang out there and crawl through some old dusty bins, the more you find out. And this was one of those stories that I found out just from literally from reading newspapers from Key West. And the story is that during the height of the Depression, Key West was in terrible, terrible straits. The majority of the population, they were on federal relief. The city had already kind of been going downhill for a couple of decades. They had lost most of their industry. They lost the cigar industry. They lost a lot of the sponging industry went to the West Coast. And so they were already in shaky times when the Depression hit. And it became so bad that the town, they were not collecting enough tax revenue, so the town had to declare bankruptcy. And so that meant that there was no, normal municipal services had stopped, like collecting garbage. Yeah. And so as I was looking through all these old pictures, there's just these photos of towering piles of garbage.
Really? Just right in the neighborhoods?
Rotting garbage on the street.
Oh, gross.
Yeah. It's so gross. And the inhabitants were so poor that they couldn't take care of their houses. You know, that's, you're not going to be painting your house and things are going to fall apart. And so it had kind of gotten to a point that it had caught the attention of the federal government, and they realized that it was getting to be very bad, like a public health hazard. And so they were trying to figure out, what are we going to do about Key West? And one idea was that they were actually just going to remove all the inhabitants and take them to the mainland and pretty much just close down the island because they couldn't, you know, bring back an industry. And then this very interesting guy named Julius Stone, who was working for the Federal Emergency Relief Agency, which was kind of an offshoot of the WPA, he went into Key West, and it was, you know, this kind of this ramshackle, falling apart town with no industry, a lot of poverty. But he saw possibility because it's beautiful. It has its very own unique culture. It's got wonderful blending of Cuban culture in Key West. It's tropical. And so he thought he could remake Key West as a tourist destination and attract like the Northeast elite to come down to it. And that's what they did. It's the story really about of them. And so what happened was the whole town pitched together to kind of spruce themselves up and clean up the town and then advertise themselves to the world as a new tourist resort. And so we find out about that in this book.
One of the most fascinating things for me was when Beans meets the artist, Avery, I think his name is, right?
Right.
And Avery's going around painting things the way that they, essentially like the way they could be. He was trying to paint a picture to attract people to come to this place, but the work hadn't been done yet. So seeing the house that was sort of dilapidated in front of him and painting it, those bright colors that we think back now and it's iconic that Key West is, the neighborhoods in Key West look like that.
Right. The pink and the yellow and the blue, like they were, they brought in real artists as part of, so Julia Stone brought them in and then they kind of continued with the WPA, brought them in to paint like picturesque postcards of what it looked like. And they even eventually, when they started rehabbing the houses, they picked these like very, you know, colorful, advertising friendly paint to paint on the houses, like pink and blue and yellow, like, which is what we think of sort of Caribbean colors.
Right.
Yeah.
I love, there's an excerpt here. Do you mind if I read an excerpt of your book to you?
No.
I always feel sheepish asking that, but I love it. In this book, I should say, Jenny, I came from teaching fourth grade. I now am a school library media specialist for 10 years or so running, but I read aloud all the time. And this book, I can't wait later to ask you about your writing process, because your books read aloud really well. And I have to feel like it must come from some part of your brain that just has an affinity toward the spoken word. But I'm going to get there. Okay, so let me read to you. Here I go. This is where Beans is seeing Avery painting. And he says, you were in Hollywood working in pictures, and now you're painting houses? You sure must have done something wrong. He made a face. It wasn't exactly in the plan, but then again, nothing ever is. I watched him paint for a little bit. You need some people in there, I told him, pointing at the canvas. He cocked his head. Otherwise, it seems kind of dead. Who would want to visit a dead town? Very astute observation, he said. I think you might secretly be an artist. No way, no how, I said. I want to be rich. I don't want to end up painting houses.
Exactly.
Well done, Jenny Holm. Well done.
No, I mean, I loved, that was fun to write, and I kind of made Avery up. I based him sort of on a pastiche of the painters that were down there, but I love the Hollywood angle. Hollywood was such a big force during the Great Depression, and in my previous job, before I was a writer, I actually worked in film production for 10 years. I was a broadcast producer. So I spent a lot of time in the film world, and it's a hard world. And so it was kind of fun to see how it played out in Key West. Because when I started doing the research into the, you know, into Key West and how they brought it back, it felt like a Hollywood movie to me. You know, like I could picture Shirley Temple in it.
Right? There are things like that. Well, and you literally bring Shirley Temple, not literally, but you figuratively bring Shirley Temple into the book by having reference to some of the movies that are being played in the theater, and having sort of Beans reflect on the outlook that she has on life. I like that. There's just so many references here that do, though. The book as a whole feels like a Hollywood story. The idea of transforming a town that's on the brink of extinction is something that I think feels, at least to me, it feels really foreign. Like, we don't think of towns dying. You think of towns living forever and ever. So to know that here's this place being experienced from kids' perspective of just going around and, like, gathering cans to sell, you know, for nickels, just to be able to get by and have kids just sort of out on the street. It's just, I don't know. There were so many things here that are so starkly different from what kids go through now, and yet so similar. I feel like so easy to grasp.
Yeah, I mean, I think especially so, you know, having to move or the fear that you're going to have to move because your parent needs to get a job somewhere, or a parent losing a job, and how that affects the whole family, even if the parents kind of keep the worst of it to themselves. I always feel that kids pick up on all of that. They know what's going on. And I think a lot of the details I got from oral histories when I was just interviewing people who had grown up in Key West during the Great Depression, some family and some friends of family, and just all these funny little details, like the collecting of the cans and making the fruit cut up. Yeah. And the best one was the cemetery, I have to say. And I had wanted to include that in Turtle in Paradise, and it just never quite worked. But a distant cousin had grown up next to the cemetery. And in Key West, the cemetery it's on the highest point of the island. It doesn't feel high, but it's quite flat, actually. But they put it up there so that it wouldn't be flooded from the ocean. You know, that was farther away from water. And the houses in Key West are built quite close together, and they're all wooden. And so if there was a fire, whole blocks would be taken down. And she was saying she remembered when she was a little kid that you know, one, when there was a fire, everybody would just, they would just start pushing their furniture and park it in the cemetery overnight because they didn't know if their house was going to be taken down in that fire.
Yeah, that idea. I don't think it's, I mean, fire plays a big part of this story in the way that, I mean, hearing things like people having the fire keys to turn on the alarms, that specific people in the community had them, and that having someone, you're right, have to evacuate all of their belongings, or the neighbors evacuate their belongings into a cemetery, no less, is something that, I don't know, I kept striking me how much there that we take for granted now that was a part of this history.
Yeah, and there were real heroes during the Great Depression down there. I mean, that was the whole thing with the one firehouse didn't close. They yes. stayed open and didn't get paid. And, you know, you go to visit that today and they talk about it. And it was really amazing at the time.
Yeah, thank you for taking us there. Oh, wait, one more thing. Thank you for taking us there in language. Because there's a... if reading it isn't enough, there's a great... section at the back, some of that added material that you've put in there. I like the quick reference of having Bean's favorite kid actors. I found that super helpful.
Yeah.
Because I know all of my kids are going to want to know about that and see who that is. And much like when we read Bluffton, Matt Phelan's graphic novel about Buster Keaton.
I love that book.
The Buster Keaton's films, because they're older, are in public domain now, so you can find a lot of them on YouTube.
Yeah.
Many of these films we can see or see clips of on YouTube, so it's so great that the technology is so accessible now to be able to reference these things so quickly.
Absolutely.
Kids can see that. But where I was going first, though, is to say, before I sidetrack myself, you've got Porkchop's best sayings here.
Yeah. And there were a lot of colorful sayings back during the Great Depression. I love mind your own potatoes.
I was just going to call out mind your own potatoes.
That's my favorite. That's my favorite.
Clearly, one of the greatest parts of your job must be researching historical phrases, right?
Yeah, and it's funny because it becomes like this weird little rabbit hole that you go down and trying to find the most colloquial sayings of the time. And for me, I listened to a lot of radio because that was sort of the dominant industry then. And you can kind of get a sense of how people talk in radio. It's a little less scripted than TV was, or it wasn't TV then. It was films were more scripted. So,
yeah, to listen to the radio archives, though, that makes sense. I was going to say, because I was picturing you going through and just watching a bunch of these old films, but then I think about some of these phrases, the phenomenon as the film comes out, and then maybe the phrase catches on or doesn't, but to have it on something like a daily or weekly radio show would really play into what the phrases are.
Yeah, I didn't get into, I played up the radio, how, you know, vital radio was in sort of everyday life during that time, more in Turtle in Paradise than in this book, but it was a pretty cool medium. So, yeah. But there was one phrase that was not historically accurate, and that's what in the history of cheese? That's my daughter made that up. She
You're
just.
Kidding.
No. And she was like, hey, what in the history of cheese? And so we started saying, it's like our family saying now, and she's surprised about something or shocked. It's so funny. So.
Word. How brilliant. So, so to have a child that talks this way. Again, I'm like fascinated by language, you and language, Jenny. So I'm going to go back to the quality of reading aloud stories. Is that something that maybe has been there in your life since your childhood? You've heard stories read aloud. You have an affinity toward reading aloud, or maybe there's just something with the written language that you are drawn toward. I'd love to know maybe even just what brought you into writing for children then.
Yeah, I think with the whole... the reading aloud, I've always been really aware of the idea of a storyteller. And I think my father, who's passed away for a while now, he was a great storyteller, and he could tell stories about funny episodes in his life and make them funny and give it a real, you know, humorous ending to it. And even if he was talking about something dark, you know, so for instance, he was a much older father. And so he grew up working on a dairy farm, and he was the oldest boy. And so he got the brunt of all the work on the farm, like milking the cows and cleaning out the urns. And so he actually ran away from home when he was either 15 or 16 years old. I can't remember what the legal age was. And he joined up with the Navy. And so he would always explain that as saying, yes, I joined up for World War II because I wanted to get some rest because he was working on the all the time. But he would deliver it in such a dry way. And I just love that sort of, and actually my brother Matt has a little bit of that snarky sense of humor too. When you, if you meet him in real life, he's kind of has that dry delivery.
There it is. So to be raised around that sort of language gets into your DNA.
Yeah. Well, it's just funny. He's kind of, he it was Scandinavian, so they aren't exactly known for their comedy, I would say. So, but when they kind of come out with it, they're little zingers.
I love it. I love it. I also love the idea of following, like, the top Scandinavian comics or something.
I know, right? Finns, we're funny. Yes.
No, really. Visit our country. We promise we're funnier than you think.
We're hilarious.
Okay, so, Jenny, what else is in the works? I'm so excited. Full of Beans, when this episode comes out, will be out in the wild.
Yes.
The readers will be, we're all starting school, and we'll have this book that is going to inevitably connect with lots and lots of readers, especially because it's coming at the start of school. So we're all, this is like my process is, I'm buying all of my books for the beginning of the school year. So there get to be things like this. And then you've got this great, beautiful neon cover for Full of Beans that's going to jump off the shelf.
I love the cover. Yeah. I
so mean, when good.
It's such a crazy slimy green. And when I saw it online, I couldn't, it wasn't coming through on my computer. And then when it showed up, I just fell in love with it.
Well, and to do it, and what a great design idea too, to then redesign Turtle in Paradise and to have it alongside 14th Goldfish, to be those three colors, the blue and yellow and green, really match in their standout-ish ways.
Totally. It was really super. I've been really lucky to work with, like, the art department's amazing.
Yeah, right. Really, on.
Yeah.
So what stuff are you working on? I'm sure there's a ton of stuff in the works, but...
Well, the big new thing, exciting thing after Full of Beans is, so, you know, for years we've been working on Baby Mouse, like we were saying. The 20th Baby Mouse actually just came out a few months ago, Baby Mouse Goes for the Gold.
Yes.
That's an Olympic book. And we've had this really unique situation over the years where it came out in 2005. So we've had about two generations of kids grow up with Baby Mouse. And, you know, so our original Baby Mouse readers are either in college or out of college by now. And one thing that's always been kind of interesting is that when kids come to, say, like a bookstore event, they're always kind of dragging, the mom or dad is always bringing the little, you know, bringing, say, the 7-year-old who wants to hear Baby Mouse, but is inevitably bringing a little brother or sister. And so we thought we wanted to introduce little Baby Mouse to the littles of our readers, to the little brothers and sisters.
Aww.
And because Matt is my little brother. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. So he's the baby of the family. And so we have a Baby Mouse is going to be coming out in picture book, and it's Little Baby Mouse and Christmas Cupcakes. And she's 4 years old. And so, and it's comic style, but full color. And we find out what happens on Christmas Eve when she eats all the cookies that are left for Santa Claus. What happens next?
Oh, adorable. And that's coming out sometime for this holiday,
fall.
Right?
Yeah, for Christmas this year.
Oh, congratulations on that.
Yeah, and so that was really fun to work on.
I'm sure. And will there be more of the, are you serializing it in some way? Are there going to be a couple?
Yeah, we hope so. We'll have to see how this one does, so fingers crossed.
Love it. I love the, maybe, well, you have insight into this, so you'll be able to tell me. Do you know, being that it's being developed for a younger reader, do you know up front whether or not they'll also develop a board book version?
For this one, we haven't actually talked about Little Baby Mouse for board books.
I don't know. I know that sometimes there are picture books that are adapted, and sometimes it's a surprise that it happens, and sometimes it's not.
Yes, exactly. So I think often, and you know, well, we did a series of board books this year, and we have two more coming out next year. Also, we did I'm Sunny and I'm Grumpy, and it was a a new series called My First Comics, and those were board books. And then we have two coming out next year. And it's all about weather characters and emotions, about toddlers and emotions. And that was something we deliberately did that as a board book. And it was a very long time in germinating. I started working on it when my daughter was three and was in preschool. And I would go to her, you know, they found out I was an author and they asked me to come and talk to the class. And I usually, Matt and I have the same presentation when we generally talk about Baby Mouse. But I kind of got in there and it was the youngest audience I'd ever been around. And, you know, they're rolling on the carpet and, you know, they can't read yet. They're 3 years old. I mean, I'm sure some of them were reading Harry Potter, but not really. I started trying to come up with very simple ideas to communicate comics to them. And then Matt and I workshopped that in kindergartens over the years. And so that's where those board books came from. Nice. But it would be fun to do little Baby Mouse board books. That's a great idea.
No, no doubt, right? And then we could answer the question of what does Baby Mouse's story taste like? Because that's what we're going through with my baby right now. Tasting all of her stories.
Yes. No, they're good. You can chew on them. You can teeth.
That's right. Her favorite right now is to give kisses to Snuggle Puppy. Aww. That's the Sandra Boynton book, Snuggle Puppy. Because she loves giving kisses to Snuggle Puppy, as you do in the song when you sang it. So adorable.
That age.
Well, I'm thinking of that too, thinking like, here you are in this position where you're writing for all these readers growing up, that you're writing for the youngest readers, the pre-readers, that you're writing for that middle grade audience. You're really getting the whole, I mean, as an elementary school teacher, for me, you're getting all of my readers in there and all of the siblings that they have that are growing up. I like that you are able to write from so many different places in your brain, to be able to sit down and write historical fiction, to be able to write graphic novels, to be able to write for the youngest. That's a talent that I think not all authors have.
Well, I think where we have been lucky is that we've been encouraged to try new things by our editors over the years, and they haven't held us back from exploring different areas. And so that's been really fun.
Well, good. Well, I'm glad you've had that push and that opportunity to try new things out. I mean, when something like Sunny Side Up results, that's such a beautiful thing. What a great and powerful story. So, I mean, everything you're doing, we could sit here and just have like the Name a Jenny Holm book and let's talk about how awesome it is. Cause that's,
aww,
you're doing a good job, Jenny. And thank you for being, I mean, you're just consistently strong. And for a reader to know that they can rely on that sort of a story with you, it's a great thing. So I'm feeling all the feels for my readers right now. And I'm glad I got to talk to you tonight because I'm feeling all the feels. It's great. All right. Well, why don't we end with them? I feel like that's a fitting thing to do. I'm going to give you the closing question, and it will be a chance for us both really to reflect on the children. So, Jenny, I'm going to see a library full of children tomorrow morning. What message would you like for me to bring them from you?
I would say you should bring one thing to bed with you every night, a book.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if the episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook and Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. coming up on the podcast, Brendan Wenzel shares They All Saw a Cat, his picture book debut as both author and illustrator. And it's a conversation I think will make you see things differently. See you then, and thanks for listening.
We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtimes a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.